The night he got so angry, Anna navigates. Can you remember when this was exactly?
Just weeks before his murder. I talk calmly, mesmerized by coals that look like glowing alligator skin. Benton knew my space needs. Even on nights when we made love, it wasn't unusual for me to wait until he fell asleep and get up with the stealth of an adulterer to slip inside my office down the hall. He was understanding about my infidelities. I feel Anna smile in the dark. He rarely complained when he reached for me and felt an empty space on my side of the bed, I explain. He accepted my need to be alone, or seemed to. I never knew how much my nocturnal habits hurt him until that night when he came into my office.
Was it really your nocturnal habits, Anna inquires, or your aloofness?
I don't think of myself as aloof.
Do you think of yourself as someone who connects with others?
I analyze, searching everywhere inside me for a truth I have always feared.
Did you connect with Benton? Anna goes on. Let's start with him. He was your most significant relationship. Certainly he was the longest.
Did I connect with him?
I hold up the question like a ball I am about to serve, not sure of the angle or spin or how hard.
Yes and no. Benton was one of the finest, kindest men I've ever known. Sensitive, deep, and intelligent, I could talk to him about anything.
But did you? I get the impression you didn't.
Anna, of course, is on to me. I sigh. I'm not sure I've ever talked to anybody about absolutely anything.
Perhaps Benton was safe, she suggests.
Perhaps, I reply. I do know there were deep places in me he never reached. I also never wanted him to. Didn't want to get that intense, that close. I suppose starting out as we did may be part of the explanation. He was married. He always went home to his wife, to Connie. It went on for years. We were on opposite sides of a wall, separated, only touching when we could sneak. God, I would never do that again with anybody. I don't care who.
Guilt?
Of course, I answer. Every good Catholic feels guilt. In the beginning, I felt terribly guilty. I've never been the type to break rules. I'm not like Lucy. Or should I say, she's not like me. If rules are mindless and ignorant, she breaks them right and left. Hell, I don't even get speeding tickets, Anna.
It is here that she leans forward and holds up a hand. This is her signal. I have said something important.
Rules, she says.
What are rules?
A definition? You want a definition of rules?
What are rules to you? Your definition, yes.
Right and wrong, I reply. What is legal versus illegal? Moral versus immoral? Humane versus inhumane?
Sleeping with a married person is immoral, wrong, inhumane?
If nothing else, it's stupid. But yes, it's wrong. Not a fatal error or unforgivable sin or illegal, but dishonest. Yes, definitely dishonest. A broken rule, yes.
Then you admit you are capable of dishonesty.
I admit I'm capable of being stupid.
But dishonest?
She won't let me evade the question.
Everyone is capable of anything. My affair with Benton was dishonest. I indirectly lied because I hid what I was doing. I presented a front to others, including Connie, that was false. Simply false. So am I capable of deception, of lying? Clearly I am.
The confession depresses me deeply.
What about homicide? What is the rule about homicide? Wrong? Immoral? Is it always wrong to kill you have killed?
Anna says.
In self-defense.
On this point I feel strong and certain.
Only when I had no choice because the person was going to kill me or someone else.
Did you commit a sin?
Thou shalt not kill.
Absolutely not.
Now I am getting frustrated. It's easy to make judgments about matters one looks at from the distant vantage point of morality and idealism. It's different when you're confronted by a killer who's holding a knife to another person's throat or reaching for a pistol to shoot you. The sin would be to do nothing, to allow an innocent person to die,
to allow yourself to die. I feel no remorse, I tell Anna. What do you feel? I close my eyes for a moment, firelight moving across my lids. Sick. I can't think about those deaths without feeling sick. What I did wasn't wrong. I had no choice. But I wouldn't call it right either, if you understand the difference. When Temple Galt was hemorrhaging to death in front of me and begging me to help, there are really no words for how that felt, and how it feels now to remember it. This was in the subway tunnel in New York. 4 or 5 years ago? She asks, and I answer with a nod. Cary Grethen's former partner in crime. Galt was her mentor, in a sense. Isn't that right? Again I nod. Interesting, she says. You killed Carrie's partner, and then she killed yours. A connection, perhaps? I have no idea. I have never looked at it like that. I am jolted by the thought. It has never occurred to me, and seems so obvious now. Did Galt deserve to die, in your opinion? Anna then asks. Some people would say he forfeited his right to be in this world, and we're all better off now that he's gone. But my God, I wouldn't have chosen to be the one who carried out the sentence, Anna. Never, never. Blood was spurting through his fingers. I saw fear in his eyes, terror, panic, the evil in him gone. He was just a human being dying, and I'd caused it, and he was crying and begging me to make his bleeding stop. I have stopped rocking. I feel Anna's full attention on me. Yes, I finally say. Yes, it was awful. Just awful. Sometimes I dream about him. Because I killed him, he will forever be part of me. That's the price I pay. And Jean-Baptiste Chandon? I don't want to hurt anybody any more. I stare at the dying fire. At least he is alive. I take no comfort in that. How can I? People like him don't stop hurting others even after they're locked up. The evil lives on. That is my conundrum. I don't want them killed, but I know the damage they do while they're alive. Lose-lose, any way you look at it, I tell Anna. Anna says nothing. It is her method to offer silences more than opinions. Grief throbs in my chest, and my heart beats in a staccato of fear. I suppose I'd be punished if I'd killed Chandon, I add. Without question I'll be punished because I didn't. You could not save Benton's life. Anna's voice fills the space between us. I shake my head as tears fill my eyes. Do you feel you should have been able to defend him, too? She asks. I swallow, and spasms of that agonizing loss rob me of my ability to speak. Did you fail him, Kay? And now it is your penance to eradicate other monsters, perhaps? To do it for Benton, because you let monsters murder him? You did not save him? My helplessness, my outrage, boil over. He didn't save himself, goddammit! Benton wandered into his murder like a dog or cat wandering off to die because it was time. Jesus! I'm out with it. Jesus! Benton was always complaining about wrinkles and sagging and aches and pains, even during the early years of our relationship. As you know, he was older than I. Maybe aging threatened him more for that reason, I don't know. But when he reached his mid-40s, he couldn't look in the mirror without shaking his head and griping. I don't want to get old, Kay, that's what he would say. I remember late one afternoon we were taking a bath together and he was complaining about his body. Nobody wants to get old, I finally said to him. But I really don't to the point that I don't think I can survive it, was his reply. We have to survive it. It's selfish not to, Benton, I said. And besides, we survived being young, didn't we? Ha! He thought I was being ironic. I wasn't. I asked him how many days of your youth were spent waiting for tomorrow, because somehow tomorrow was going to be better. He thought about this for a moment as he pulled me closer in the tub, touching and fondling me beneath the steamy cover of hot water scented with lavender. He knew exactly how to play me back in those days when our cells came alive instantly on contact, back then when it was good. Yeah, he considered, it's true. I've always waited for tomorrow, thinking tomorrow's going to be better. That's survival, Kay. If you don't think tomorrow or next year or the year after that will be better, why bother? I stop for a moment, rocking. I tell Anna, well, he stopped bothering. Benton died because he no longer believed what was ahead was better than what was past. It doesn't matter that it was another person who took his life. Benton was the one who decided. My tears have dried, and I feel hollow inside, defeated and furious. Feeble light touches my face as I stare into the afterglow of fire. Fuck you, Benton, I mutter to smoking coals. Fuck you for giving up. Is that why you had sex with Jay Talley? Anna asks. To fuck Benton? To pay him back for leaving you? For dying? If so, it wasn't conscious. What do you feel? I try to feel. Dead. After Benton was murdered, I consider this. Dead, I decide. I felt dead. I couldn't feel anything. I think I had sex with Jay. Not what you think, what you feel, she gently reminds me. Yes, that was the whole thing. Wanting to feel, desperate to feel something, anything, I tell her. Did making love with Jay help you feel something, anything? I think it made me feel cheap, I reply. Not what you think, she reminds me again. I felt hunger, lust, anger, ego, freedom. Oh, yes, freedom. Freedom from Benton's death? Or perhaps from Benton? He was somewhat repressed, wasn't he? He was safe. He had a very powerful superego. Benton Wesley was a man who did things properly. What was sex like with him? Was it proper? Anna wants to know. Thoughtful, I say. Gentle and sensitive. Ah, thoughtful. Well, there is something to be said for that, Anna says with a hint of irony that draws attention to what I have just revealed. It was never hungry enough, never purely erotic. I am more open about it. I have to admit that many times I was thinking while we were having sex. It's bad enough to think while talking to you, Anna, but one shouldn't think while making love. There should be no thoughts, just unbearable pleasure. Do you like sex? I laugh in surprise. No one has ever asked me such a thing. Oh, yes, but it varies. I've had very good sex, okay sex, boring sex, bad sex. Sex is a strange creature. I'm not even sure what I think of sex, but I hope I've not had the premier grand cru of sex. I allude to superior Bordeaux. Sex is very much like wine, and if the truth be told, my encounters with lovers usually end up in the village section of the vineyard, low on the slope, fairly common and modestly priced, nothing special, really. I don't believe I've had my best sex yet, my deepest, most erotic sexual harmony with another person. I haven't, not yet, not at all. I'm rambling, speaking in stops and starts as I try to figure it out and argue with myself about whether I even want to figure it out. I don't know. Well, I guess I wonder how important it should be, how important it is. Considering what you do for a living, Kay, you should know how important sex is. It is power. It is life and death, Anna states. Of course, in what you see, mainly we are talking about power that has been terribly abused. Sean Dunn is a good example. He gets sexual gratification from overpowering, from causing suffering, from playing God and deciding who lives and who dies and how. Of course. Power sexually excites him. It does most people, Anna says. The greatest aphrodisiac, I agree, if people are honest about it. Diane Bray is another example. A beautiful, provocative woman who used her sex appeal to overpower, to control others. At least this is the impression I have, Anna says. It's the impression she gave, I reply. Do you think she was sexually attracted to you? Anna asks me. I evaluate this clinically. Uncomfortable with the idea, I hold it away from me and study it like an organ I am dissecting. That never entered my mind, I decide. So it probably wasn't there, or I would have picked up the signals. Anna doesn't answer me. Possibly, I equivocate. Anna isn't buying it. "Didn't you tell me she had tried to use Marino to get to know you?" she reminds me. "That she wanted to have lunch with you, socialize, get to know you, and try to arrange this through him?" "That's what Marino told me," I reply. "Because she was sexually attracted to you, possibly? That would have been the ultimate overpowering of you, wouldn't it? If she not only ruined your career, but helped herself to your body in the process, and therefore appropriated every aspect of your existence? Isn't that what Sean Dunn and others of his type do? They must feel attraction, too. It is simply that they act it out differently from the rest of us. And we know what you did to him when he tried to act out his attraction to you. His big mistake, no? He looked at you with lust and you blinded him. At least temporarily." She pauses, her chin resting on her finger, her eyes steady on me. I am looking directly at her now. I have that feeling again. I would almost describe it as a warning. I just can't put a name to it. "What might you have done had Diane Bray tried to act out her sexual attraction to you, saying it was there, if she had hit on you?" Anna keeps digging. "I have ways of deflecting unwanted advances," I reply.
"From women, too?"
"From anyone."
"Then women have made advances?"
"Now and then, over the years." "It is an obvious question with an obvious answer. I don't live in a cave." "Yes, I've certainly been around women who show interest I can't reciprocate," I say.
"Can't or won't?"
"Either."
"And how does it make you feel when it is a woman who desires you? Any different than if it is a man?"
"Are you trying to find out if I'm homophobic, Anna?
Are you?"
I consider this. I reach as deep as I can to see if I am uncomfortable with homosexuality. I have always been quick to assure Lucy that I have no problem with same-sex relationships, beyond the hardships they bring.
"I'm okay with it," I answer Anna. "Really and truly. It simply isn't my preference. It's not my choice."
"People choose?"
"In a sense."
"Of this I am certain. And I say so because I believe people feel many attractions that aren't what they would be most comfortable with, and so they don't act on them. I can understand Lucy. I've seen her with her lovers, and in a way envy their closeness, because although they have the difficulty of going against the majority, they also have the advantage of the special friendships women are capable of having with each other. It's harder for men and women to be soulmates, deep friends. I'll admit that much. But I think the significant difference between Lucy and me is, I don't expect to be a man's soulmate, and men make her feel overpowered. And true intimacy can't occur without a balance of power between the individuals. So because I don't feel overpowered by men, I choose them physically." Anna says nothing. "That's probably as much as I'll ever figure it out," I add. "Not everything can be explained. Lucy and her attractions and needs can't be completely explained, nor can mine."
"You really don't think you can be a man's soulmate? Then maybe your expectations are too low? Possible?"
"Very possible." I almost laugh. "If anyone has low expectations, I deserve to, after all of the relationships I've fucked up," I add.
"Have you ever felt attracted to a woman?"
Anna finally gets to this. I figured she would. "I have found some women very compelling," I admit. "I remember getting crushes on teachers when I was growing up."
"By crushes, you mean sexual feelings?"
"Crushes include sexual feelings, innocent and naive as they may be. A lot of girls get crushes on their female teachers, especially if you're in a parochial school and are taught exclusively by women."
"Nuns."
I smile. "Yes, imagine getting a crush on a nun."
"I imagine some of those nuns got crushes on each other, too,"
Anna remarks. A spreading dark cloud of uncertainty and uneasiness encroaches on me, and a warning taps at the back of my awareness. I don't know why Anna is so focused on sex, particularly homosexual sex,
and I entertain the possibility that she is a lesbian, and this is why she never married. Or maybe she is testing me to see how I might react if she finally, after all these years, tells me the truth about herself. It hurts to think she might have, out of fear, withheld such an important detail from me. You told me you moved to Richmond for love. It is my turn to probe. And the person proved a waste of time. Why didn't you go back to Germany? Why did you stay in Richmond, Anna?
I went to medical school in Vienna, and am from Austria, not Germany, she tells me. I grew up in a Schloss, a castle that had been in the family for hundreds of years, near Linz on the Danube River, and during the war the Nazis lived in the house with us. My mother, my father, two older sisters and my younger brother. And from the windows I could see the smoke from the crematorium some 10 miles away at Mauthausen, a very notorious concentration camp, a huge quarry where prisoners were forced to mine the granite, carrying huge blocks of it up hundreds of steps. And if they faltered, they were beaten or pushed into the abyss. Jews, Spanish Republicans, Russians, homosexuals. Day in and day out, dark clouds of death stained the horizon, and I would catch my father staring off and sighing when he thought no one was looking. I could feel his deep pain and shame. Because we could do nothing about what was happening, it was easy to slip into denial. Most Austrians were into denial about what was happening in our beautiful little country. This was unforgivable to me, but could not be helped. My father had much wealth and influence, but to go against the Nazis was to end up in a camp, or to be shot on the spot. I can still hear laughter and the clink of glasses in my house, as if those monsters were our best friends. One of them started coming into my bedroom at night. I was 17. This went on for 2 years. I never said a word because I knew my father could do nothing, and I suspect he was aware of what was going on. Oh yes, I am sure of it. I worried the same thing was happening to my sisters, and am quite certain it was. After the war, I finished my education and met an American music student in Vienna. He was a very fine violinist, very dashing and witty, and I came back to the States with him, mainly because I could not live in Austria any more. I could not live with what my family had averted its conscience from, and even now, when I see the countryside of my homeland, the image is stained with that dark, ominous smoke. I see it in my mind always, always. Anna's living room is chilled, and fire-scattered embers look like dozens of irregular eyes glowing in the dark. "What happened with the American musician?" I ask her. "I suppose reality introduced itself." Her voice is touched by sadness. "It was one thing for him to fall in love with a young female Austrian psychiatrist in one of the most beautiful, romantic cities in the world. Quite another to bring her back to Virginia, to the former capital of the Confederacy, where people still have Confederate flags all over the place. I began my residency at MCV, and James played with the Richmond Symphony for several years. Then he moved to Washington, and we parted. I'm grateful we never married. At least I did not have that complication, that or children. And your family? I ask. My sisters are dead. I have a brother in Vienna. Like my father, he is involved in banking. We should get some sleep, Anna says. I shiver when I first slide beneath the covers, and I draw up my legs and tuck a pillow beneath my broken arm. Talking to Anna has begun to unsettle me around the edges, like the earth about to cave in. I feel phantom pains in parts of me that are past, gone, and my spirit is heavy from the added burden of the story she has told about her own life. Of course she would not volunteer her past to most people. A Nazi association is a terrible stigma, even now, and to consider that fact causes me to paint her demeanor and her privileged lifestyle on a very different canvas. It doesn't matter that Anna no more had a choice about who stayed in her family home than she had a say about who she had sex with when she was 17. She would not be forgiven if others knew. My God, I mutter, staring up at the ceiling in Anna's dark guest room. Dear God.
I get back up and make my way down the dark hallway, passing through the living room again and into the east wing of the house. The master bedroom is at the end of the hallway, and Anna's door is open, thin moonlight seeping through windows and softly outlining her shape beneath the covers.
"Anna," I speak quietly, "are you awake?"
She stirs, then sits up. I can barely make out her face as I come closer. Her white hair is down around her shoulders. She looks 100 years old.
"Is everything all right?"
she asks groggily and with a trace of alarm.
"I'm sorry,"
I tell her. "I can't tell you enough how sorry I am.
Anna, I've been a terrible friend." "You have been my most trusted friend."
She reaches for my hand and squeezes it, and her bones feel small and fragile beneath soft, loose skin, as if she has suddenly become ancient and vulnerable, not the Titan I have always envisioned. Perhaps it is because I now know her story.
"You've suffered so much, carried so much all alone," I whisper. "I'm sorry I've not been there for you. I'm just so sorry,"
I tell her again. I bend over and hug her awkwardly, cast and all, and kiss her cheek. Chapter 8. Even during my most burdened, distracted moments, I appreciate where I work. I'm always aware that the medical examiner system I head is probably the finest in the country, if not the world, and that I co-direct the Virginia Institute of Forensic Science and Medicine, the first training academy of its kind. I am able to do all of this in one of the most advanced forensic facilities I have ever seen. Our new $30 million, 130,000-square-foot building is called Biotech 2 and is the center of the Biotechnology Research Park, which has stunningly transformed downtown Richmond by relentlessly replacing abandoned department stores and other boarded-up shells with elegant buildings of brick masonry and glass. Biotech has reclaimed a city that continued to be bullied long after those northern aggressors fired their last shot. When I moved here in the late 80s, Richmond consistently topped the list of cities with the highest homicide rate per capita in the United States. Businesses fled to neighboring counties. Virtually no one went downtown after hours. That can be said no more. Remarkably, Richmond is on its way to becoming a city of science and enlightenment, and I confess, I never thought it possible. I confess I hated Richmond when I first moved here, for reasons that reach far deeper than Marino's nastiness to me, or what I missed about Miami. I believe cities have personalities. They take on the energy of the people who occupy and rule them. During its worst era, Richmond was stubborn and small-minded, and bore itself with the wounded arrogance of a has-been, now ordered about by the very people it once dominated, or in some instances, owned. There was a maddening exclusivity that caused people like me to feel looked down on and alone. Through it all, I detected the traces of old injuries and indignities as surely as I find them on bodies. I found a spiritual sadness in the mournful haze that during summer months clings like battle smoke over swamps and endless stands of scrawny pines, and drifts along the river, swathing the wounds of brick pilings and foundries and prison camps left from that awful war. I felt compassion. I did not give up on Richmond. This morning, I struggle with my growing belief that it has given up on me. The tops of buildings in the downtown skyline have vanished in clouds, the air thick with snow. I stare out my office window, distracted by big flakes drifting past, as phones ring and people move along the corridor. I worry that state and city government will shut down. This can't happen on my first day back. "Rose," I call out to my secretary in the adjoining office. "Are you keeping up with the weather?"
"Snow,"
her voice sails back. "I can see that. They aren't closing anything yet, are they?" I reach for my coffee and silently marvel over the unrelenting white storm that has seized our city. Winter wonderlands typically grace the Commonwealth west of Charlottesville and north of Fredericksburg, and Richmond is left out. The explanation I have always heard is that the James River in our immediate area warms up the air just enough to replace snow with freezing rains that sweep in like Grant's troops to paralyze the earth. Accumulation of possibly 8 inches, tapering off by later afternoon with lows in the 20s.
Rose must have logged on to an internet weather update.
Highs not to get above freezing for the next 3 days. It looks like we'll have a white Christmas. Isn't that something? Rose, what are you doing for Christmas?
Nothing much, her response comes back.
I scan stacks of case files and death certificates and push around phone message slips, mail, and inner office memos. I can't see the top of my desk and don't know where to start.
8 inches?
They'll declare a national emergency, I comment. We need to find out if anything's closing besides schools. What's on my schedule that hasn't already been canceled?
Rose is tired of yelling through the wall at me. She walks into my office, looking sharp in a gray pants suit and white turtleneck sweater, her gray hair pinned up in a French twist. She is rarely without my big calendar and opens it. She runs her finger over what is written in it for today, peering through half-moon reading glasses.
The obvious is we now have 6 cases and it's not even 8 o'clock yet, she lets me know. You're on call for court, but I have a feeling that's not going to happen.
Which case?
Let's see. Mayo Brown, don't believe I remember him.
An exhumation, I remember.
A homicidal poisoning, a rather shaky one.
The case is on my desk somewhere.
I start looking for it as muscles tense in my neck and shoulders.
The last time I saw Buford Ryder in my office, it was over this very case, which was destined to create nothing but confusion in court, even after I spent 4 hours explaining to him the dilution effect on drug levels when the body has been embalmed, that there is no satisfactory method to quantitate the rate of degradation in embalmed tissue.
I went over the toxicology reports and prepared Ryder for the defense of dilution. Embalming fluid displaces blood and dilutes drug levels, I drilled into him. So if the decedent's codeine level is at the low end of the acutely lethal dose range, then prior to embalming, the level could only have been higher. I meticulously explained that this is what he needs to focus on because the defense is going to muddy the waters with heroin versus codeine. We were seated at the oval table in my private conference room, paperwork spread before us. Ryder tends to blow out a lot when he is confused, frustrated, or just pissed off. He continued to pluck up reports and frown at them, and then put them back down, all the while blowing like a whale breaking surface.
Greek, he kept saying.
How the hell do you make the jury understand things like C-monoacetylmorphine is a marker for heroin, and since it wasn't detected, then it doesn't necessarily mean heroin wasn't present, but if it was present, then that would mean heroin was too? Versus telling if codeine is medicinal?
I told him that was my point, the very thing he didn't want to focus on. Stick to the dilution offense. That the level had to have been higher before the person was embalmed, I coached him. Morphine is a metabolite of heroin. Morphine is also a metabolite of codeine, and when codeine is metabolized in the blood, we get very low levels of morphine. We can't tell anything definitively here, except we have no marker for heroin, and we do have levels of codeine and morphine, indicating the man took something, willingly or unwillingly, before he died. I painted the scenario for him. And it was a much higher dose than is indicated now because of the embalming, I stressed again.
But do these results prove the man's wife poisoned him with Tylenol 3, for example?
No. Don't get gummed up in the tar baby of C-monoacetylmorphine, I told Ryder repeatedly. I realize I am obsessing. I'm sitting at my desk angrily going through stacks of backed-up work as I anguish over how much trouble I went to preparing Ryder for yet another case, promising I would be there for him, just as I always have been. It is a shame he does not seem inclined to return the favor. I am a free lunch. All of Chandon's Virginia victims are free lunches. I just can't accept it, and am beginning to resent the hell out of Jamie Berger, too.
Well, check with the courts, I say to Rose. And by the way, he's being released from MCV this morning. I resist saying Jean-Baptiste Chandon's name. Expect the usual phone calls from the media. I heard on the news this New York prosecutor's in town. Rose flips through my date book. She doesn't look up at me. Wouldn't that be something if she gets snowed in? I get up from my desk, take off my lab coat, and hang it on the back of my chair. I don't guess we've heard from her. She hasn't called here. Not for you. My secretary hints she knows that Berger did track down Jack, or at least someone besides me. I am very skilled at becoming prepossessed with business and deflecting any effort on another person's part to probe an area I choose to avoid. To expedite things, I say, before Rose can give me one of her pregnant looks, we'll skip staff meeting. We need to get these bodies out of here before the weather gets any worse. Rose has been my secretary for 10 years. She is my office mother. She knows me better than anyone, but doesn't abuse her position by pushing me in directions I don't want to go in. Curiosity about Jamie Berger fizzes on the surface of Rose's thoughts. I can see questions rising in her eyes, but she won't ask. She knows damn well how I feel about trying the case in New York instead of here, and that I don't want to talk about it. I think Dr. Chong and Dr. Fielding are already in the morgue, she is saying. I haven't seen Dr. Forbes yet. It occurs to me that even if the Mayo Brown case goes forward today, even if the courts don't close because of snow, Reiter isn't going to call me. He will stipulate my report and resort to putting the toxicologist on the stand at best. There is no way in hell Reiter is going to face me after I called him a coward, especially since the accusation is true, and a part of him must know it. He will probably figure out a way to avoid me the rest of his life, and that unpleasant thought leads to another one as I cross the hallway. What does all this bode for me? I push through the ladies' room door and make the transition from civilized paneling and carpeting through a series of changing rooms into a world of biological hazards, starkness, and violent attacks on the senses. Along the way, one sheds shoes and outer clothing, stowing them safely in teal-green lockers. I keep a special pair of Nikes parked near the door that leads inside the autopsy suite. The shoes are not destined to walk through the land of the living ever again, and when it is time to get rid of them, I will burn them. I clumsily arrange my suit jacket, slacks, and white silk blouse on hangers, my left elbow throbbing. I struggle into a full-length mega-shield gown that has viral-resistant front panels and sleeves, sealed seams, and a gripper neck, which is a snug stand-up collar. I pull on shoe covers, then an OR cap and surgical mask. The final touch of my fluid-proofing is a face shield to protect my eyes from splashes that might carry such frights as hepatitis or HIV. Stainless steel doors automatically open, and my feet make paper sounds over the tan vinyl floor of the biohazard epoxy-finished autopsy suite. Doctors in blue hover over 5 shiny stainless steel tables fastened to steel sinks, water running, hoses sucking, X-rays on light boxes, a black-and-white gallery of organ-shaped shadows, and opaque bones, and tiny bright bullet fragments that, like loose metal chips in flying machines, break things and cause leaks and vital gears to seize. Hanging from clips inside safety cabinets are DNA specimen cards that have been stained with blood. They look oddly like a bunting of tiny Japanese flags as they air-dry beneath a hood. From closed-circuit television monitors mounted in corners, a car engine rumbles loudly in the bay, a funeral home here to deliver or take away. This is my theater. It is where I perform. As unwelcome as the average person might find the morbid odors, sights, and sounds that rush to greet me, I am suddenly and immensely relieved. My heart lifts as doctors glance up at me and nod good morning. I am in my element. I am home. A sour, smoky stench taints the long, high-ceilinged room, and I spot the slender, naked, sooty body on a sheet-covered gurney that has been rolled out of the way of traffic. Alone, cold, and silent, the dead man waits his turn. He waits for me. I am the last person he will ever talk to in a language that matters. The name on the toe tag, scrawled in permanent magic marker, pitifully, is John Doe. Someone couldn't spell Doe right. I tear open a packet of latex gloves and am gratified I can stretch one over my cast, which is further protected by the fluid-proof sleeve. I am not wearing the sling, and will have to resort to doing autopsies with my right hand for a while. Although being left-handed in a right-handed world has its difficulties, it is not without advantages. Many of us are ambidextrous, or at least reasonably functional on both sides.
My aching, fractured bones radiate reminders that all isn't right in my world, no matter how tenaciously I go about my business, no matter how intensely I focus on my work.
I slowly circle my patient, leaning close, looking. A syringe is still embedded in the crook of his right arm, and second-degree burns blister his upper body. They have bright red margins, and his skin is streaked black with soot that is thick inside his nose and mouth. He is telling me he was alive when the fire started. He had to be breathing to inhale smoke. He had to have a blood pressure for fluid to be pumped into his burns, causing them to blister and have a bright red margin. The circumstances of a set fire and the needle in his arm certainly could suggest suicide. But on his right upper thigh, he has a contusion that is swollen to the size of a tangerine and crimson. I palpate it. Indurated, hard as a rock. It appears recent. How did it happen? The needle is in his right arm, suggesting that if he injected himself, he most likely is left-handed. Yet his right arm is more muscular than his left one, hinting he is right-handed. Why is he nude? "We still don't have an ID on him?" I raise my voice to Jack Fielding. "No further info." He snaps a new blade into a scalpel. "The detective's supposed to be here."
"Found unclothed?"
"Yep." I run my gloved fingers through the dead man's thick, carbon-dusted hair to see what color it is. I won't be certain until I wash him, but his body and pubic hair are dark. He is clean-shaven with high cheekbones, a sharp nose, and square jaw. Burns on his forehead and chin will need to be covered up with funeral home makeup before we can circulate a photograph of him for identification purposes, if it comes to that. He is fully rigorous, arms straight by his sides, fingers slightly curled. Liver mortis, or the blood settling to dependent regions of the body due to gravity, is also fixed, causing the sides of his legs and buttocks to be a deep red, the backs of them blanched wherever they rested against the wall or the floor after death. I hold him tilted on his side to check for injuries to his back, and find parallel linear abrasions over the scapula. Drag marks. There is a burn between his shoulder blades and another one at the base of the back of his neck. Clinging to one of the burns is a fragment of a plastic-like material, narrow, about 2 inches long, white with small blue type on it, such as you might see on the back of a food product's packaging. I remove the fragment with forceps and hold it up to the surgical lamp. The paper is more like thin, pliable plastic, a material I associate with candy or snack wrappers. I make out the words, "this product," and 9-4 EST, and a toll-free number and part of a website address. The fragment goes inside an evidence bag. "Jack?" I summon him and begin collecting blank forms and body diagrams, attaching them to a clipboard.
"I can't believe you're going to work with that damn cast on."
He walks across the autopsy suite, his bulging biceps straining against the short sleeves of his scrubs. My deputy chief may be famous for his body, but no amount of weightlifting or chocolate cream Myoplex high-protein meals in a glass can stop him from losing his hair. It is eerie, but in recent weeks his light brown hair has started falling out before our very eyes, clinging to his clothing, drifting through the air like down, as if he is molting.
He frowns at the misspelling on the toe tag. The guy from the removal service must be Asian. John Doe.
Who's the detective? I ask.
Stanfield. Don't know him. Just don't get a puncture in your glove or you'll be wearing a biological hazard for the next few weeks.
He indicates my latex-coated cast.
Actually, what would you do, now that I think of it?
Cut it off and put on a new one.
So maybe we should have disposable casts down here.
I feel like cutting it off anyway. This guy's burn pattern isn't making sense to me, I tell him. Do we know how far the body was from the fire?
About 10 feet from the bed. I was told the bed's the only thing that burned, and only partially. He was nude, sitting on the floor, back against the wall.
I wonder why only his upper body got burned. I point out discreet burns, the size and shape of silver dollars. Arms, chest, one here on his left shoulder, and these on his face. And he has several on his back, which should have been spared if he was leaning against the wall.
What about the drag marks? As I understand it, when the fire department got there, they dragged his body out into the parking lot. One thing's for sure, he must have been unconscious or incapacitated when the fire started, Jack says. Sure as hell don't know why else someone would just sit there getting burned and breathing in smoke. Obviously that happy holiday time of year.
My second-in-command is cloaked in a hungover weariness that causes me to suspect he had a very bad night. I wonder if he and his ex-wife had another one of their explosions.
Everybody killing themselves. That woman over there.
He points to the body on table one, where Dr. Chung is busy taking photographs from a stepladder.
Dead on the kitchen floor. A pillow. A blanket. The neighbor heard one shot. Mother found her. There's a note. And behind door number two, Jack stares at table two. A motor vehicle death the state police are suspicious is a suicide. She has extensive injuries. Plowed right into a tree.
Did her clothes come in?
Yep.
Let's x-ray her feet and get the labs to check the bottom of her shoes to see if she was braking or accelerating when she hit the tree.
I shade areas of a body diagram indicating soot. And we got a known diabetic with a history of overdose.
Jack recites our guest list of the morning.
Was found outside in the yard. Question is, drugs, alcohol, or exposure?
Or a combination of the above.
Right. I see what you mean about the burns, though.
He leans closer to look, blinking often, reminding me he wears contact lenses.
And it's weird they're all about the same size and shape. You want me to help with this?
Thanks, I'll manage. How are you?
I glance up from my clipboard.
His eyes are tired, his boyish good looks strained.
Maybe we can grab some coffee sometime, he says, one of these days. And I should be asking about you.
I pat his shoulder to let him know I am okay.
As well as can be expected, Jack, I add.
I begin the external examination of John Doe with a perk. This is a physical evidence recovery kit, a decided unpleasantness that includes swabbing orifices, clipping fingernails, and plucking head, body, and pubic hair. We perk all bodies when there is any reason to suspect something other than a natural death, and I will always perk a body that is nude, unless there is an acceptable reason for the person's not being clothed when he died, in the bathtub or on the operating table, for example. For the most part, I don't spare my patients indignities. I can't. Sometimes the most important evidence lurks in the darkest, most delicate hollows, and clings underneath nails and in hair. During my violation of this man's most private places, I discover healing tears of his anal ring. He has abrasions at the angles of his mouth. Fibers adhere to his tongue and the inside of his cheeks. I go over every inch of him with a lens, and the story he tells grows more suspicious. His elbows and knees are slightly abraded and covered with dirt and fibers, which I mundanely collect by pressing them with the adhesive backs of Post-its, which I seal inside plastic bags. Over the bony prominences of both wrists are incomplete circumferential dry reddish-brown abrasions and minute skin tags.
I draw blood from the iliac veins and vitreous fluid from the eyes, and test tubes ride up on the dumbwaiter to the third-floor toxicology lab for stat alcohol and carbon monoxide tests. At 10:30, I am reflecting back tissue from the Y incision when I notice a tall, older man heading toward my station. He has a wide, tired face and maintains a safe distance from my table, gripping a grocery-size brown paper bag, the top folded over and sealed with red evidence tape. I have a flash of my bagged clothing on my red Jarrah Wood dining room table. Detective Stanfield, I hope? I hold up a flap of skin and free it from ribs with small, quick strokes of the scalpel.
Good morning.
He catches himself as he stares at the body.
Well, I guess not for him.
Stanfield hasn't bothered with protective clothing over his ill-fitting herringbone suit. He wears no gloves or shoe covers. He glances at my bulky left arm and refrains from asking me how I fractured it, telling me he already knows. I am reminded that my life has been all over the news, which I am adamant in my refusal to follow. Anna has halfway accused me of being chicken, as much as a psychiatrist is allowed to accuse, and she would never actually use the word chicken. Denial is her word. I don't care. I'm staying away from newspapers. I don't watch or listen to a goddamn thing that is said about me.
"Sorry it took so long, but the roads out there are bad on their way to awful, ma'am," Stanfield says. "Hope you got chains on your tires, 'cause I didn't and got stuck. Had to get the tow truck and then get the chains put on, so that's why I wasn't here earlier. You found out anything?"
His CO is 72%. Vernacular for carbon monoxide. Notice how cherry red the blood is? Typical in high levels of CO. I pick up rib shears from the surgical cart. Stat alcohol zero.
So it was the fire that got him for sure?
We know he had a needle in his arm, but carbon monoxide poisoning is his cause of death. Doesn't tell us much, I'm afraid. I cut through ribs. He's got anal tunneling, evidence of homosexual activity, in other words, and his wrists were bound at some point prior to his death. It appears he was gagged. I point out the abrasions on the wrists and the corners of the mouth. Stanfield's eyes pop open. The abrasions on his wrists aren't crusty, I go on. They don't look old, in other words. And because he has fibers in his mouth, you can be pretty certain he was gagged at or around the time of death. I hold a lens over the antecubital fossa, or crook of the arm, and show Stanfield two tiny blood spots. Fresh injection sites, I explain. But what's interesting is he has no old needle tracks to suggest a history of drug abuse. I'll put a block of liver through to check for triaditis, mild inflammation of the structural support system of bile duct, artery, and vein, and we'll see what comes back on his tox.
Guess he could have AIDS.
This is foremost on Detective Stanfield's mind. We'll do an HIV on him, I reply. Stanfield backs up another step as I remove the triangular-shaped breastplate of ribs. This is a stage cue for Laura Turkle, on loan to us from the Graves Registration Unit at the Fort Lee Army Base in Petersburg. She is so attentive and officious and almost salutes me when she suddenly appears at the end of the table. Turk, as everyone knows her, always refers to me as Chief. I suppose for her, Chief is a rank, and Doctor isn't.
Ready for me to open up the skull, Chief?
Her question is an announcement that requires no answer. Turk is like a lot of the military women we get in here, tough, eager, quick to eclipse the men, who often, truthfully, are the squeamish ones.
That lady Dr. Chong's working on,
Turk says as she plugs the striker saw into the overhead cord reel. She's got a living will and even wrote her own obituary. Got all her insurance papers in order, everything. Put them all in a binder and left it and her wedding band on the kitchen table before she laid herself down on the blanket and shot herself in the head. Can you imagine? Really, really sad. It's very sad. The organs are a shimmering block as I lift them out en masse and set them on a cutting board. If you're going to be in here, you really should cover up. I direct this at Stanfield. Did anybody show you where things are in the locker room?
He blankly stares at the cuffs of my blood-soaked sleeves, at the blood splashed on the front of my gown. "Ma'am, if you don't mind, I'd like to go over what I got," he says. "If we could maybe sit down for a minute? Then I need to head on back before the weather gets any worse. Pretty soon you're going to need Santa's sleigh to get anywhere."
Turk picks up a scalpel and makes an incision around the back of the head, ear to ear.
She reflects back the scalp and pulls it forward, and the face goes slack, collapsing into tragic protest before it is inside out like a folded-down sock. The exposed dome of the skull glistens pristinely white, and I take a good look at it. No hematomas, no indentations or fractures. The whir of the electric saw sounds like a hybrid of a table saw and a dentist's drill as I pull off my gloves and drop them in a red biohazard trash can. I motion Stanfield to follow me to the long countertop that runs the length of the wall opposite the autopsy stations. We pull out chairs.
"I gotta be honest with you, ma'am," Stanfield begins with a slow, negative shake of his head. "We don't got a clue where to start on this one. All I can tell you right now is this man," he indicates the body on the table, "checked into the Fort James Motel and Campground yesterday at 3 p.m.
"Where exactly is this Fort James Motel and Campground?"
"On Route 5 West, no more than 10 minutes from William and Mary."
"You talked to the clerk at this motel, the Fort James Motel?"
"The lady in the office, yes, ma'am, I did."
He opens a large manila envelope and scoops out a handful of Polaroid photographs.
"Her name's Bev Kiffin."
He spells it for me, slipping reading glasses out of an inner jacket pocket, hands trembling slightly as he flips through a notepad.
"She said the young man come in and said he wants the 1607 special.
"I'm sorry, the what?" I rest my ballpoint pen on the notes I am making.
$160.70 Monday through Friday. That's 5 nights. 1607. The usual rate's $46 a night, which is mighty high for a place like that, you ask me. But you know tourist traps."
1607? As in the date Jamestown was founded? It seems odd to hear a reference to Jamestown. I just mentioned Jamestown to Anna last night when I was talking about Benton. Stanfield nods deeply.
"As in Jamestown. 1607. That's the business rate, or so they call it. The amount for the business week. And let me add, ma'am, this isn't a very nice motel. Not at all. No, ma'am. A flea bag is what I would call it."
"Does it have a history of crime?"
"Oh, no. No, ma'am. No history of crime I'm aware of. Not at all."
"Just seedy."
"Just seedy."
He nods deeply. Detective Stanfield has a distinct way of speaking with emphasis, as if he is used to teaching a slow child who needs important words repeated or emphasized. He neatly arranges photographs in a lineup on the countertop, and I look at them. "You took these, I assume?"
"Yes, ma'am, I sure did."
Like him, what he has captured on film is emphatic and to the point. The motel door with the number 14 on it, the view of the room through the open doorway, the scorched bed, the smoke damage to the curtains and walls. There is a single chest of drawers and an area to hang clothes that is nothing more than a rod in a recessed area just inside the door. I note that the mattress on the bed has remnants of a cover and white sheets, but nothing else. I ask Stanfield if perhaps he submitted the bed covers to the labs to test for accelerants. He replies that there was nothing on the bed, nothing to submit except burned areas of the mattress, which he placed inside a tightly sealed aluminum paint can.
"According to procedure," are his exact words,
the words of someone very new at detective work. But he does agree it is odd that the bed covers were missing. "They were on the bed when he checked in?" I ask.
"Mrs. Kiffin says she didn't accompany him to the room, but is sure the bed was properly made because she cleaned it up herself after the last guest checked out several days ago," he replies.
"So that is good. At least he thought to ask her about it." "What about luggage?" I ask next. "Did the victim have luggage?"
"Didn't find any luggage."
"And the fire department got there when?"
"They were called at 5:22 p.m.
Who called? I am making notes.
Someone anonymous driving by saw smoke and called from his car phone. This time of year, the motel doesn't do a lot of business, according to Mrs. Kiffin. She says about 3/4 of the rooms was empty yesterday, being as how it's almost Christmas and the weather and all the rest. You can see by looking at the bed the fire wasn't going nowhere.
He touches several of the photographs with a thick, rough finger.
It pretty much had put itself out by the time the fire trucks got there. All they needed was fire extinguishers. Didn't need to hose things down, which is a good thing for us. This here's his clothes.
He shows me a photograph of a dark pile of clothing on the floor just beyond the open bathroom door. I make out pants, a T-shirt, a jacket, and shoes. Next, I look at photographs taken inside the bathroom. On the sink is a copper-tone plastic ice bucket, plastic glasses covered with cellophane, and a small bar of soap, still in its wrapper. Stanfield fishes in a pocket for a small knife, opens a blade, and slits the evidence tape sealing the paper bag he brought with him.
His clothes, he explains. Or at least I assume they're his.
Hold on, I tell him. I get up and cover a gurney with a clean sheet and put on fresh gloves and ask him if a wallet or any other personal effects were recovered. He tells me no. I smell urine as I pull out clothing from the bag, careful that if any trace evidence is dislodged, it will fall on the sheet. I examine black bikini briefs and black Giorgio Armani cashmere trousers, both soaked with urine.
He wet his pants, I tell Stanfield.
He just shakes his head and shrugs, and doubt crosses his eyes. Maybe doubt tainted by fear. None of this is making much sense, but the feeling I have is clear. This man may have checked in alone, but at some point another person entered the picture, and I'm wondering if the victim lost control of his bladder because he was terrified. Does the lady in the office, Mrs. Kiffin, remember him dressed like this when he checked in? I ask as I pull pockets inside out to see if there is anything in them. There isn't.
Didn't ask her that, Stanfield responds. So he's got nothing in his pockets. That's kind of unusual.
No one checked them at the scene?
Well, I didn't bag the clothes, to tell you the truth. Another officer did that, but I'm sure nobody dug in the pockets, or at least no personal effects was found, or I would know and have them with me, he says.
Well, how about you call Mrs. Kiffin right now and see if she remembers him wearing this clothing when he checked in? I politely tell Stanfield to do his job. And what about a car? Do we know how he got to the motel?
No vehicles turned up so far.
The way he was dressed is certainly inconsistent with a low-budget motel, Detective Stanfield. I'm drawing pants on a clothing diagram form. The black jacket and black T-shirt, as well as the belt, shoes, and socks, are expensive designer labels, and this makes me think about Jean-Baptiste Chandon, whose unique, baby-fine hair was found all over Thomas's decomposing body when it showed up in the Richmond port earlier this month. I comment on the similarity of the clothes to Stanfield. The prevailing theory, I go on to explain to him, is that Jean-Baptiste murdered his brother Thomas, probably in Antwerp, Belgium, and switched clothing with him before sealing the body inside a cargo container bound for Richmond.
Because you found all those hairs I've been reading about in the paper?
Stanfield is trying to understand what would be difficult for even the most experienced investigator who has seen it all. That and microscopic findings that relate to diatoms, algae, consistent with an area of the Seine near the Chandon house in Île-Saint-Louis in Paris. I talk on. Stanfield is completely lost. Look, all I can tell you, Detective Stanfield, is this man, I refer to Jean-Baptiste Chandon, has a very rare congenital disorder and allegedly has been known to bathe in the Seine, maybe thinking it might cure him. We have reason to believe the clothing on his brother's body was originally Jean-Baptiste's. Make sense? I am drawing a belt and noting from the indentation in the leather which notch was used the most.
Well, to tell you the truth, Stanfield replies, I've been hearing about nothing but this weird case and this werewolf fellow. I mean, ma'am, that really is all you hear when you turn on the TV or pick up the paper, and I guess you know that. And by the way, I'm really sorry for what you've been through, and to tell you the truth, can't figure how you can even be in here or thinking straight. God almighty, he shakes his head. The wife said if something like that showed up at our door, he wouldn't have to do a thing to her. She'd die right off of a heart attack.
I catch a spark of his misgivings about me. He is wondering if I am completely rational right now, if I might just be projecting, if somehow everything I experience becomes tainted by Jean-Baptiste Chandon. I slip the clothing diagram off the clipboard and place it with John Doe's paperwork as Stanfield dials a number he reads from his notepad. I watch him insert a finger in his free ear, squinting as if Turk's sawing open another skull hurts his eyes. I can't hear what Stanfield is saying. He hangs up and comes back over to me as he reads the video display of his pager.
"Well, we got good news and bad news," he announces. "The lady, Mrs. Kiffin, remembers him dressed real nice in a dark suit. That's the good news. The bad news is she also remembers he had a key in his hand, one of those remote kinds that a lot of new, expensive cars have."
"But there's no car," I reply.
"No, ma'am, no car. No key either," he says. "Sure looks like whatever happened to him, he had some help. You think maybe somebody drugged him and then tried to burn him up to hide the evidence?"
"I think we'd better seriously consider homicide," I state the obvious. "We need to get him printed and see if he matches up with anybody in APHIS." The automated fingerprint identification system allows us to scan fingerprints into a computer and compare them with those in a database that can be linked state to state. If this dead man has a criminal record in this country, or if his prints are in the database for some other reason, we most likely will get a hit. I work my hands into a pair of fresh gloves, doing my best to cover the plaster looped around my left lower palm and thumb. Fingerprinting dead bodies requires a simple tool called a spoon. It is nothing more than a curved metal implement shaped much like a hollow tube cut in half lengthwise. A strip of white paper is threaded through slits in the spoon so that the paper's surface is curved to accommodate the contours of fingers no longer flexible or compliant to their owner's will. With each print, the strip is advanced ahead to the next clean square. The procedure isn't hard. It doesn't require great intelligence. But when I tell Stanfield where the spoons are, he frowns as if I have just spoken to him in a foreign language. I ask him if he has ever printed a dead body before. He admits he has not. "Hold on," I say, and I go to the phone and dial the extension for the fingerprints lab. No one answers. I try the switchboard. Everyone is gone for the day because of the weather, I